Welcome to the Nature Reliance Podcast, where we explore the history and practical experience of the great outdoors and discover new ways to connect with nature. I'm Craig Cottle, your guide through the fascinating world of natural living and survival skills through experiential education and interviews. Today's episode is brought to you by the Nature Reliance School Online Membership, an immersive online learning experience designed for outdoor enthusiasts just like you. Are you passionate about the outdoors? Do you crave more knowledge about disaster readiness, wilderness survival, bushcraft, tracking, and nature awareness? If so, the Nature Reliance School Online Membership is your gateway to a community of like-minded individuals, all dedicated to learning and sharing essential outdoor skills. With the Nature Reliance School Online Membership, you get exclusive access to a wealth of resources, including expert-led tutorials, interactive webinars, and a library of engaging courses, downloadable books, and documents. Whether you're a beginner or an experienced outdoorsman, there's always something new to learn. So don't wait. Click on the link below to join the Nature Reliance School Online Membership today. Embrace the wilderness, enhance your skills, and become part of a community that values nature as much as you do. Now, let's dive into today's episode. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Nature Reliance Media Podcast. I'm your host, Craig Cottle, today. Glad to be with you, and I do have a treat that you're going to enjoy, I promise. I was very fortunate to sit down with my friend Joe Flowers from Bushcraft Global. I met Joe many years ago at SHOT Show in Las Vegas, and we've chatted off and on ever since, and I've just got to tell you, Joe's got to be one of the most energetic people that I've ever been around in my life. It's just infectious to hang out with a guy. The interview, I guess that's what we should have started calling it, but it ended up not being an interview as much as it was just a conversation between two guys. And it ranged in topics from beekeeping. Joe's done some incredible research at the university level on bees. We end up talking about his knife designing with Condor knives, and he makes an announcement about somebody else he's going to be designing knives. I'll leave that up to him into the podcast so you can hear that from him. We also talk about, obviously, his jungle expeditions, which he's very good at doing and has done numerous trips down to South America and other parts of the world, and he's got a lot of new stuff coming that way. And we also talk about the industry of bushcraft and survival and how some people are lone wolf and perhaps the rest of us are more collaborative. And I think that's the way we want to see it, and that's the way we want to move forward. And it's great to hear Joe talking about it, and he's very kind to me. And I was very happy to be able to sit down with him and talk. So enjoy the podcast. Here comes Joe. Hey, Joe.
Hello. Welcome to the show. How are you, Craig?
I'm good, man. It's good to hear from you.
Now, viewers or listeners, you guys can't, I don't know if you've talked about your setup, but he's got this really cool, it looks like cedar or wormwood background in the corner.
That's actually just some. That's just covering on the wood, man, on the drywall. It makes it look pretty.
Okay. Yeah, no, artwork, guys, he's in a cabin, a log cabin out
in the middle. Let's see. It looks good. And Joe, for those that are listening in, because we're recording this so we can see each other, makes it a little bit more conversational, everybody. But Joe, I'm assuming this is your home, Joe, huh?
Yeah, this is my office. Yeah. And somehow I got faster internet up here in the mountains. But we had a renovation, so later on, you know, if you come down and hang out, I can show you the Bushcraft Library. Of course, Doug Meyer helped me get most of my books, if you know who he is. But
I'm interviewing him next week too, Joe. I'm gonna get
He's great.
Yeah, he's coming to the gorge to do some, I think he and his wife are gonna do some photography, and we're gonna meet up and do some tracking and do an interview in the woods somewhere. So
he is pretty pumped about showing track in Kentucky. He's like, man, that's like my backyard. This gorge, wait, is it Red River?
Or Red River Gorge.
Yeah. I think you should probably do some kind of class with him later with that, because he loves that place. What,
it's been crazy. I've actually taught in the gorge this past weekend. I've taught in the gorge twice in the past month. So I'm getting more comfortable learning how to teach strangers how to be there. I'm sure you know what I mean. It's 100%. I'm comfortable there, but making sure other people are safe and comfortable while they're training is a big issue for me. So
I take people out into the jungle, and it's not necessarily training. It's more of an experience, but like Craig, I don't think we would have gotten into this if we didn't like hosting people and making sure they had a good time, you know, while they're learning, while they're getting all this intense teaching. And that's important. When you show people how to be in a new environment to where they're having fun, man, they're going to be learning a lot more than, hey, here's one candy bar for the rest of the week. You're good.
Right. Yeah. No joke. I had a special forces instructor tell me many years ago, he was like, Craig, why do survival like it's special forces selection? You're not doing that. Let special forces selection do that. That's what they're there for.
Right.
And you're an educator. You teach people. And I'm, that's one of the reasons I want to get you on, because I know you feel the same way.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%.
Yeah.
And like, I have not been on one of your courses yet, but even in the more extreme ones, are you starving people at all or anything like that?
Well, yes and no. I mean,
just based on the course, you know.
Most of our stuff is 3 days, so okay, that's not really an issue. It basically, I force people to think. And so, like, more of our advanced survival courses are like, you can carry 20, 25 pounds or less, and they get to choose.
Oh, cool.
And so it forces awesome. It. They get to choose to eat well. Basically, when we do those courses, it's wintertime. So it usually forces people to choose, am I going to sleep real well or am I going to eat real well? And they make that choice on their own. And because I like to force people to use their noggin as much as they can.
You know, one of the questions you asked me earlier is some of the goals that I have for myself this year. And in the wintertime camping, I do it, you know, I live up in the mountains. But I'm still honestly baby.
Real quick, let's take a step back first.
Yeah.
And tell everybody, you know, where you got started. And when you say the mountains, what mountains are you in, and tell everybody that.
Ah, okay. Well, I guess I can introduce myself and do all that fun stuff too. So I'm Joe Flowers. I am a designer for Condor Tool and Knife, Topps Knives. I'm going to let you know on this podcast first, so that you get it. I just picked up Artisan Knives.
Oh, yeah.
Nobody else knows that. So that's a scoop or something there. I also teach around the U.S., but I live up in the Appalachian Mountains of North Carolina, right along the Virginia and North Carolina border, right in the foothills. Like, the tallest point in Virginia is maybe 45 minutes away from my house. So it gets cold here. It's not super epic cold, but it's definitely colder than, as we would say, down the mountain where it, and honestly, which is funny and quite humbling, because I really enjoy hot weather.
Oh, really?
Yeah, big time. I love Florida. I love the jungle, of course. I take people down to South America and even Central America on Amazon jungle bushcraft trips with my company that I own called Bushcraft Global. And you can imagine it gets hot down there. So I really, really like that. And you know, cold weather happens up here, but I'm just not, I really like the creepy crawlies and I really like reptiles and amphibians. I'm actually a zoology major, with a minor in entomology, and worked for the Department of Entomology at NC State for a long time. And I loved it because it was out in the heat. Mm-hmm. Come up here where it's cold, there's not really much need for an entomologist. So I picked up or worked on knife designing a lot harder.
Very good.
During the winter months.
So how, when you were doing entomology work, what were you doing?
Beekeeping.
Oh yeah.
I managed over like 100, in between 100 to 200, hives, doing research, all sorts of queen bee hereditary stuff with, genetics, and a lot of field research, because I was a field technician. I was the one out there making sure all the bees are ready to go for all the grad students and doing all this stuff. So I've been stung a lot.
Yeah. Oh, I imagine.
So used to be no problem at all, man. Craig, you'd be working out there so much in Raleigh, North Carolina, in that 90 degree weather. It got to the point where you stopped wearing protective gear because it was just so hot. And
right.
If you go slow and you're deliberate with the bees, you can get away with not getting stung, going through many, many different hives. And that, back in my heyday, that was really good. Nowadays, I still put on a veil over my face because I don't like getting stung in the face. It's pretty cool.
So what was the research focused on? I mean, what were you doing specifically? Were you trying to make sure they're healthy? Because, I mean, that's critical right now, right?
Yeah, big time. We did a whole bunch of research on CCD, colony collapse disorder, which is the big thing that knocked the bees down during the early 2000s. And we got different queens from different areas, did a whole genome research on them, saw what they did during the winter time. If the queen left to go on another mating flight, you know, or if she went and split away from the colony, what the colony does it evacuate like all these other bees are doing, this, all this weird stuff. So there was a lot of research during the 2000s on this collapse disorder. And what they kind of found out was it was a combination of pesticides and also where they're getting some of the bee sources from, like royal jelly, which is something that you feed to a queen to make her badonkadonk huge. And then she's able to lay in all these different cells. But the royal jelly had something with it. This was theorized. None of this.
That's like a food source for the queen? This royal, yes. What you're calling royal jelly? Okay.
Yeah. So royal jelly is this really interesting protein-packed superfood. They even use it in cosmetics, but they give it to a normal, unfertilized egg, a female. So when they fertilize the egg, it becomes a male, a drone. They don't do anything, but they feed this superfood to a larvae, and it makes it a queen. It changes it physiologically. So the queen is physiologically different. You know, when you see a queen bee, she's completely different looking physically, unlike a bumblebee, where the queen isn't, you know, physically different. She rules by just beating up other bumblebees. A honeybee is physiologically different. The queen is very different than all the other bees. And it was
so
really
hold
cool
her up. I mean, that's why they set her apart. I mean, just because she does look different, she doesn't have to abuse the other bees to.
No. She has a pheromone, which is basically like a queen smell. QMP, queen mandibular pheromone. You won't be tested on this later, don't worry. and the bees react to that. We even did, you know, a fake queens, little pieces of paper with the QMP, the queen mandibular pheromone, on it to make the bees, you know, do the retinue response where they all circle her and pay attention to a piece of paper. It was really, really neat.
Wow. That kind of stuff fascinates me, man. That's pretty cool. Interesting.
Dude, it was, you know, the other awesome part, Craig, is you have to light a smoker all the time, you know, because the smoker, for those who don't know, it's that little thing that you puff that puts a whole bunch of smoke into a bee colony. And that keeps them from telling the other bees, hey, let's go sting Joe, for instance. It keeps them calm. It also makes them think that their hive is on fire. So they go and they eat all the honey up really, really quickly. And use it in their honey stomachs in case they need to leave. And it's just like you and me at a Chinese buffet where we eat a whole bunch of food and then we're like, we don't want to move. So the smoke is really cool. But, you know, this was during the early 2000s. And of course, you know, fire steels were just becoming super popular. So I every single day was out there with the fire steel or some kind of different way to challenge myself to make a fire, spark based fire. And this was like 10 times a day, you know, it was super fun. And so I got to test everybody's ferocium, you know, out there, all the different qualities and quantities. And, that was super cool.
So wouldn't be what you would call the start of like bushcrafting for you, would it? Or you doing that before you went to university or
big time? So I got started, you know, probably maybe like how you did, I don't know, watching TV too much and watching Crocodile Dundee. Cause I'm I was born in 83 and Crocodile Dundee, I think came out in 85 or 86. And there was this dude who was really good at bushcraft, who really liked reptiles, and he carried a big honking knife.
I never thought about that, man. That's you, isn't it? That's what you wanted to be when you grew up.
Exactly. You know, that or a dinosaur, you know, it was either paleontology or Crocodile Dundee, and paleontology because I couldn't actually be a dinosaur when I was little. So like when I was 7 and 8, I like wasted the VHS dubbed copy of Crocodile Dundee. And I had like a little whittled Bowie knife that I'd always carry with me made out of like a tree stump, a root. So it was really solid. And I'd run around the creeks and catch snakes, the safe snakes and do all this stuff. So, you know, I went to college for zoology, but had always been a fan of knives. And if you're not a fan of knives and you don't have a bucket of knives, or in my case, like a whole, all that's full of knives. A whole bunch of
those are listening in. Joe's pointing to a bunch of cabinets behind him that cover a whole wall. So those are all full of knives, right,
Joe? Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Exactly. Way too many. I tell my wife I'm writing a book about it, so I can buy more. That's a tip,
just
guys.
So you know,
if you're doing it.
No, I use that too.
Good. All right. Perfect. Yeah. Our wives don't listen to podcasts. We're good. That's
right. It's the same reason with books too. I mean, yeah. Honey, it's just 100%. Research.
Exactly.
I've got to get more books. It's just research.
Oof. I mean, if you hang out with Doug Meyer, we'll backtrack to how I got started. You're in trouble. But so I'd always been going on the knife forums. I'd been a knife nut ever since I was a kid. I got the same Smoky Mountain Knife Work magazines everybody else has got in the mail. Always looked at knives. When I was like in high school, I looked at some of my vocabulary books recently, and they had knife drawings everywhere.
Oh, wow. Nice.
And you know, I always knew I liked to draw them and stuff, but I got in contact with Stephen Dick of Tactical Knives Magazine. This one's from 2002. He knew the gentleman, Terrell Hoffman, actually, who we just talked about. Mm-hmm. Stephen Dick was the editor of Tactical Knives Magazine. And I had been a subscriber to this for a long time and loved it. Was on the forums a lot doing stuff with knives. There's a big thing there. Instead of just looking at them, going out in the bush and doing stuff. And so I got to write for him. He liked what I did. And a little bit longer, you know, I started going to Blade Show. I'd really been into machetes big time, you know, the different uses of them. So I walked up to Condor Tool and Knife, who had just been there maybe a year, 2 years, and said, "What are you guys doing? Just do what you guys know." Condor Tool and Knife is a knife company, by the way, owned and run down in El Salvador, which is in Central America. The country is the size of South Carolina, and a third of their people are in the U.S. sending money back to El Salvador, which is on the U.S. dollar. So they're very dependent on the United States economy, because one third of their population is already in the United States working. And they make these things. Imakasa makes 40,000 machetes, I think, a month. Oh, 40,000 machetes. Man. Maybe the second biggest machete manufacturer in the world, next to Tramontina, which is in Brazil and also Colombia now. So I walked up to them like, "Look, I've been a huge machete nerd, right? You know, we're into this stuff because we love it. What are you guys doing? Just put better edges and don't make every handle Smurf blue. Nobody likes Smurfs unless you're Gargamel and you eat them. Just do black handles." Right. Everybody likes black handles. So they did this. They're like, "Hey, do you want to submit some designs?" And, you know, I submitted some. And 10 years later, a 300-400% increase in sales. I'm still working under them as a consultant. So it's been
fantastic,
awesome. Man. It's a very weird and different ride. You know, I'm allowed to work with other companies too. Topps Knives, a U.S. made manufacturer. They're absolutely awesome knives. And I got to know Mike Fuller, who passed away during COVID, sadly. Topps Knives is a U.S. manufacturer. They came out with about 6 different designs over the years, maybe some new ones coming out too. And they helped me start Bushcraft Global, which I'll get to in a second. So that's where the knife stuff comes in. And guys, anybody, if I can design a knife, anybody can. You know, it's the world's oldest cutting tool. I mean, there's a reason why we're here today, right? And it's not because we were gnawing on bones. It's because we took an edge that gave us what Steve Watts likes to say, an edge that gave us the edge over all other living animals. And with the ability to cut stuff, we were able to make fire, we were able to make weapons, process food, you know, do all this stuff. So it's very, very much in our blood. Anybody can design a knife. So
I'm not as much a knife nerd. So I love hearing this sort of stuff, because I there's a lot of stuff that I don't know about the knife industry, if you will, and the background.
Yeah.
And the Smurf Blue, was that something that was kind of like their thing at the time? And
yeah,
they just
If you look at some of their original designs, Arlen Loth, which was a great designer. I believe he did the marbles. Oh, I'm sorry. The a certain axe done by one company. And listeners, I'm sorry, I can't remember it right now. It was the something belt axe. They really were good with sharpeners. It'll come to Lansky, I think. No, it'll come to me later. I'm sorry. But he also was a guy who did the Miracle Blade for the kitchen industry. Buy on TV, the Miracle Blade. And then he came to Condor or Imakasa, which is Condor's parent company, and said, hey, let's do some stuff. And they came out with some crazy designs. I don't know who decided blue. I don't think it was that designer's choice. I think it was just them trying to get out in the market. They started to make this really sexy, dark navy blue, which I liked. I still have some of the old ones probably lying around. Yep, lying around here. And it almost looks black. Right. So they started to dumb down the colors and then saw, hey, you know, not everybody wants this bright color. And if you're going to pick a bright color, do like all the other cool knife companies and pick orange, not light blue.
Yeah. So I guess.
Hey, so tell me, you know, we're talking about knife designing. You have that awesome, almost Filipino looking knife that begins with an S, which name Chamonix. I can't remember. Chamonix. Tell me about that.
We'll be back after a quick break.
Hey guys and gals, a quick break in our episode to talk about a game changer in outdoor cooking, the Fire Maple Backpacking and Camping Stove System. Whether you're hiking, fishing, or even prepping for emergencies, this portable pot and jet burner is a must-have in your gear. Best part? It's nearly half the price of a comparable JetBoil stove system. Thanks to its leading heat exchange technology, you'll experience reduced boiling times by up to 30% compared to traditional stoves, even in windy conditions. That means more time enjoying the outdoors and less time cooking. Are you ready to upgrade your outdoor cooking game? Click the link in the description now to grab yours. Trust me, your outdoor adventures will never be the same. Well, I grew up doing reenacting, period, correct.
Oh, cool.
Pre-Revolutionary War type stuff. So I worked.
We need to back up on this because that's part of my big blade talk that I talked about. Anyway, go ahead.
But I like at Fort Boonesboro, which is one of the more famous forts here in this part of the country. It was a place that I went to and made flint and steel fires as a kid, you know, for tourists. I grew up doing that, doing competition, black powder shooting, and dressing up like Daniel Boone and running around the woods and stuff. And so I fell in love with the idea of the long hunter's knives, what were called the long knives. Shawnee called them the Chamonix because that was what they both called the knives and the men that carried them. So I just took what I thought were the long knife concept that came from that period of time, added some flavor to it that I thought was Craig Cottle flavor and how I do things and what I do. And LT Wright was very happy with building it and it's been really successful. It just, for me, I mean, I didn't know the first order I had to order 50, right. To make sure that we were taking
care of their minimum quantities. Yeah.
Yeah. And I had no idea if I would sell 50. I had no idea if I'd sell 10. I thought I could sell 10 or 15 and I would slowly but surely sell the others. And I sold the first 50, you know, in 2 weeks. Wow. It was just incredible. It was incredible. And we've just been selling them over and over and over again.
Yeah, it's sold out now on the website too, right?
It is. I can't, and you know this better than I do, Joe. I can't figure out the formula for how many knives people want. I don't know how to do it. So
honestly, bro, that's why I design and I don't sell because I can't do math. It's really hard and I'm just lucky where I'm at. But LT Wright is an incredible knife maker. I've known him. We've probably camped out. LT and I with Practice What You Preach and some of the other campouts, no less. Actually, if I ask LT, this probably is true. No less than maybe 20 times, because we've known each other for a decade. And he teaches classes. I went and took this candy grind class with him. I've loved them ever since, you know, Blind Horse Knives and Self-Reliance Illustrated came out. They're just such a good, trustworthy, loyal, just amazing dude company. You're happy to have LT as a friend. You're happy to have his knife because it's, you know, God knows how many people on a loan one with that knife, you know. Right. So it's so dependable. And your big knife with a point down the center line, you know, Craig, there was a really interesting thing, you know, that happened because we're talking bushcraft, and of course, with bushcraft comes knife craft, woodcraft, and this American frontiersman heritage that we all have. With the taming of, you know, this last frontier that is the United States, with the taming of both the indigenous that were here and also the biggest thing I'll come back to in a second is there was a time when the big knives were super, super duper important. And large knives, because you wanted the dude who's trying to, you know, take your scalp, you want them this far away versus, you know, like right up in your close combat vicinity. You want them farther away. But you're also doing camp chores, you're making shelters, you're processing animals, and it's much easier to do small knife skills with the big knife than it is big knife skills with the small knife. But the other big thing, when we started seeing Kephart and Nessmuk style knives and these smaller, you know, hunting knives that were very popular with marbles, we had the repeating rifle. People didn't have to have a backup plan if they missed with that first shot with their musket, right? Like even in the Civil War, there's a plethora of history on the Civil War Bowie and the small dirks that were used, because what happens if you miss that first shot with your musket? Right. So with the invention of multiple shots, the big knife became a lot smaller and more of a useful piece. But we don't have to worry about that. We're looking at all the other aspects. Although it would make an awesome, you know, self-defense tool, you still want a larger knife. And I believe this one looks pretty thin, which is a smart way to go.
Well, the two things that I think stand out about it that are different, which it goes right along with what you're saying, is number one, I study knife fighting. So yeah. I wanted a blade that all the blades that I use, the way I've been trained in Filipino combat systems, have some sort of curve like that.
Yeah,
some sort of angle like that. And there's reasoning for that. It's in knife fighting, but I wanted it in my knife that I'm going to carry. And number two, I grew up making teepees, like full size teepees, not wiki ups like you see in bushcraft classes now, like the big things. Yeah. And so we would take, you know, huge amounts of pole pines to build teepees out of them. And we use draw knives to do it. And so,
did you know, to get a lodgepole pine now, they're like $90 a piece, dude, for like a teepee.
And my dad's got a barn full of them that we've kept.
Oh my gosh.
Just kept them in the barn for the teepees. And he just, I mean, it's one of those, you want to be driven crazy. Both my dad and my uncle, who both have teepees, don't want me to use them.
Oh my gosh. Come on, man. Craig Cottle.
Dude, they don't. I don't know. Anyway, it's frustrating. It's frustrating. I would love nothing more than to set those teepees up again and teach a class in them, but they don't want me to use
them. There are heirloom ones, you know.
Oh, I guess that's it, man. I guess when I get them, that's when I get to use them. So, oh, well, anyway. But yeah, the other thing too was the thinness of a blade. I think we've kind of got into this idea of we got to have this big, thick blade that's going to cut through the hood of a car. And I'm more interested in cutting through the rib cage of a deer and filleting fish.
Yeah, you know, you see all these, and I'm very, this is calling the kettle black because I've designed some thick knives, but most machetes, most large knives, even the American Hudson Bay, they make them a fourth of an inch thick. In reality, they were an eighth of an inch thick. I mean, these are butcher knives that are used. You don't need a huge thick knife to stick into a bad guy or to process a fish. You know, you want to have that flexion on stuff. And even the American machetes, like the Ontario ones, as awesome as they are, they're super thick compared to the workhorses that you'll see down in Central and South America. So it's awesome that you did a thin, big knife.
Oh, I caught some flack for it, as you can imagine. Everybody, that knife's too thin. That's too long. And I'm like, it's too thin and too long for you, bro.
Yeah,
it's not too thin, you know, and too long for me.
it's too. Is it not thick enough so you can, you know, open up a bottle? I mean, what are you doing with it versus what he's doing with it out in the field for real? Right. You know,
I need to hang around with you more, Joe, because you can back me up on all this stuff, and you got a lot more understanding of it than I do.
I don't know. Honestly, it's just hanging out with the people who do. Because you know, I wasn't born, you know, in the jungles and do all that, but like a 5-year-old down there can use a machete better than I can. Listeners, one of the interesting things that you may not think about with the thin machetes is when a lot of different indigenous are sharpening a machete, and you can imagine this long, you know, blade, they only sharpen the end of it in the first like 8 to 6 inches so that they can use the back end of the machete where you think an edge would be, right? So they can use that for very, very fine using. So sometimes, like when I bring a client down to South America and they're dealing with these four different tribes, they're like, Joe, my machete's sharper than theirs and it has more of an edge. I'm like, yeah, well, they're not going to pick yours up because they think it's dangerous. They would rather right. just have all the sharpness at blade or a small blade task with the big blade. And it's super interesting because I'm like, oh man, I'd never do that to my like $300 blah, blah, blah. But then I'm like, gosh, these guys are out carving me with a machete and a butcher knife. And I need to take some humble pie that way.
Right. That's a good way to learn a lesson though. You know, I mean, people that are going to use that have to use their knives every day.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a lot of us, truth be told, we don't have to use our knives. We choose to use them. Right. Those folks have to use them.
Guys, even like the best bushcraft instructors in the US, you know, or whatever, the first thing they're doing when they wake up in the morning, me too, is okay, I better look at my Instagram and see if I'm getting, you know, likes or something. Whereas, you know, Alberto down in South America, my Yukuna guide, first thing he does is pick up his machete and he goes and fix some thatching or gets a mango off of a tree. And, you know, it's super humbling with that too. You learn safety. You learn how much self-reliance you get with your hands. You know, it's not just self-reliance based on you know, the piece of gear that you have, but just what can you do with your hands and that piece of gear? Or what can you do with your knowledge and that piece of gear? And I think it really opens people up to learn more about themselves rather than, you know, play Rambo. So that, you know, kind of went hand in hand with Condor. Imakasa and El Salvador, they're a tremendous machete use country. Everybody's walking around with the machete. And so learning the skills from them and even the kids, I've been humbled by 5-year-olds, you know, play fighting. You know, I'm a Shotokan black belt. I had my own dojo up until a year ago because of, you know, knee stuff, which happens when you're a striker. You know, being able to move around, do all that, I thought, all right, I got footwork. I got pride. You know, I could do all this with any other fighter, but man, just play fighting with a stick and a 5-year-old who's the first thing that they pick up is a machete. Oh man, right. it's humble pie. You know, right. it's hilarious. And that's in these cultures and it's super neat to learn from them.
Well, that takes me into my next question. If you don't care, tell us about sure. these jungle trips that you lead and what you do on them and that sort of thing.
Well, as we stated before, I like creepy crawlies and bugs and reptiles and amphibians a lot, hot weather and big knives. If you put that all together, you can see where I'm going here. It's jungle right. basically. And you know, Essie knives, right? Jeff sure. Randall.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Super awesome training. I had been a fanboy of theirs for a while. When I first started with El Salvador and Imakasa Condor, I had been interested in going on a jungle trip with Jeff for a while. And Jeff and I had become friends because he's a very accomplished writer and photographer before he did all this kick-ass training. And I said, hey, Jeff, you guys need a machete? And he's like, yeah, do you know where we could source blades? And I'm like, I might know someone. And so their first machete thing was kind of put together and he said, yeah, you can come on one of my jungle trips and, you know, trade this source and all this stuff for that. So that was the first time I got in real jungle. You know, I'd been to Haiti and other places like that, but it was only for a few days versus Jeff in the thick of it with Essie. Super
awesome
training.
What was taking you to Haiti? I mean, what took you to Haiti at that point in time? Were you going there?
That was... it was a cruise ship thing with my, with my wife, but when they dropped us off there, yeah. Tourism type stuff. I would go past the fence and ask which area is a safe area and find a guy who spoke English and said, all right, you're going to take me while my wife is hanging out on the beach. I'm going to go around the compound and go into the thick stuff and learn, you know, within reason. I wasn't a dumb, I wasn't an idiot with it. You know, I was like, that looks sketchy. I'm going to go back this way. If you don't want to take me there, then you're off. You know, I'm not paying you anymore. But I've seen crazy, like Haitian kids are really, really good with kitchen knives. Very, very good. They could take like a coconut and put it faster than like an adult processor. Blows my mind. But so that El Salvador has some jungle. I've been tromping around in that jungle a little bit. Costa Rica as well. When my wife and I went on our honeymoon to Costa Rica, we tacked on a few extra days so I could go play out in the jungle. But it was only a few days, right, Craig? And that's not a great way to experience it. Jeff's thing, I was like, gosh, this is awesome. I can't wait to get back to jungle again. So after Jeff's training, I'm going to put the story, very, very long story, very, very short.
Okay. Take your time, man.
No, no worries. There was a dude going from one side of South America all the way to the other, walking to raise money for cancer. His name was Mickey Grossman.
Yeah.
Mickey. And he's, okay. Then the crazy Israeli ex-special forces dude.
Right.
Super interesting to be out in the field with for 30 days, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
Running this whole entire...
I followed that trip.
Okay, I was on it. There you go. Okay. This is how everything
great.
Started.
Okay, I did not
know
that. I was
down there for 30 days. He got dengue fever and got loopy and got arrested. And I was the one who had to take over the entire expedition liaison and make sure all the camera equipment was protected. By the way, guys, this is a really good way to do this if you're ever in this kind of situation. Find a pastor. Ask if there's another American pastor because they're everywhere. Found a guy my age. He was like, yeah, I run a tourism business, but I'm also a pastor. I'm like, of course, you know, out in these small jungle towns, you know, they're everywhere. And became friends with him, put all the very expensive equipment of Mickey's into the a thing. Mickey got arrested because he was very loopy from dengue fever and mouthed off to Brazilian FBI. And they got really ticked off and ended up, you know, trying to show him a lesson. So he's getting arrested while I'm talking about the HK and the other guy's hand. And we're just hanging out. He's like, what's up with your friend? I'm like, go easy on him. He has dengue fever. Like, no, no, you can't scream at people. Shoot me. I don't care. So, Mickey had to be put in jail, but I went over there, made sure he was put in solitary, and helped him get through this dengue fever, which was hemorrhagic. Dengue fever, guys, mosquito disease, cough up blood, not good. So there was a point in time there where we were pretty worried, but after he got stable, he was still in jail and we had to figure out what to do. Honestly, I came down there because I like creepy crawlies, lizards, all that stuff, but I was in a tiny village where there wasn't any animals. I was like, take me to the nearest spot where I can find critters. And they're like, you need to go to this place and sleep a night there. And so I went to this one natural preserve. And that was probably one of the most enjoyable nights I've ever had in the outdoors because I saw spiders as big as my hand, cute little possums the size of, I don't know, like an action figure, like a G.I. Joe figure.
Like that's sloths. Their full grown size?
Yeah. They're like a 4-inch tall possum hanging off of a tree like a Christmas ornament, all cute, like
that's fantastic.
Huge beady eyes. And you know, of course, I'm flipping out over the boa that I caught and these tarantulas and sloths everywhere. And, you know, I'm like, gosh, Craig, what I said to myself was, I need to come back here every single year or else I'm not going to feel whole. This is like where, you know, I feel part of me is. So I wake up in the morning. And there's this German dude smoking a cigarette. You know, you can tell he's had to deal with a bunch of foreigners everywhere.
Right.
And he goes, yeah, man, what do you do? And I'm like, well, I design knives professionally. I'm overseeing an expert. He goes, knives? I love knives. He like got almost excited. And of course, me, I'm super excitable too. You know, my eyes beaded up. I'm like, yeah, check out this one. He goes, oh my gosh, you need to come to my house right now. Turns out he was the owner of the natural reserve. He's a Serbian who's lived there 25 years. He takes me to a treehouse, Craig, of his own design that is multi-level, 12 feet up off the ground, made out of Amazon hardwoods. It's a beautiful, it looks like Robinson Crusoe thing of his own design. He doesn't have couches. He has hammocks. He goes, this is a Matisse Rides friction this fire. Awesome. This is their 12-foot long blowgun. Blah, 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 this. The only people who are allowed to talk with them are through me because I hunt with them. And he's like, I'd really like to bring people down here and learn these techniques. I'm like, you mean like this technique? He's like, how the hell do you know that? I'm like, because I'm in academia. I like to research this. Doug, of course, has helped me a little bit, of course, with blowguns. And he's like, dude, this is great. Can you bring people down here? And I'm like, yes, can we ensure this? And that's how Bushcraft Global started. So
that's fantastic.
Yeah, Mickey got out of jail.
Is this gentleman still around? I mean, is he still
part of? He's my best friend.
Okay, great. Okay,
the Tanimboca Puco. from Topps is his design. Okay. So is the mini Tanoboca. So that's Goren. My best friend, one of my best friends, we talk to each other more than teenage girls do on WhatsApp. We text each other all the time. And yeah, he's this badass dude who sounds like Arnold Schwarzenegger, and he makes knives out of Volkswagen steel out in the middle of the jungle, and he goes around and he catches animals, but he also owns an ecotourism resort thing, so he has tons of insurance. Yeah, and so long story short, this Mickey Grossman situation back in 2011, 2010, I can't remember.
Was it that long ago? Dang.
Yeah, it was long Golly. Ago. Yeah, big deal. He got out of the jail, and we were able to post bail, and he had to stay in the country for a little while. So we go about an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours up the river, and we're filming while he's, you know, recuperating for a week, fighting. He's like, dang, Joe, you were really good at finding animals. I'm like, I know, just wait. And so we go out at night and we find like 50,000 animals, because I'm, you know, completely overly hyped and stimulated by the jungle environment. He's like, okay, I'm feeling good now. You need to go back a week early, because they were getting farther and farther away from the airport. And so I was like, I know where I'm gonna kill a week. And so Gordon and I just hung out and we're friends for a week. And you know, he showed me how the indigenous make bows down there. And so that's how Bushcraft Global started.
That's fantastic, which is, man.
Of course, I'm wearing 5'11" like every bushcraft instructor does, with their logo on the side right now. And I'm flashing the logo to Craig, but yeah. So that's it.
And how often do you go down there, Joe? How often do you take trips down there?
It's once a year. This year it's gonna be twice a year. Honestly, guys, it's when my wife lets me. It's I gotta get, you know, babysitters for the kids until they're able to come down. But I go down there at least once a year to the Amazon River proper. This year I'm going down twice. I make visits down there regularly because they're like family friends. Their daughter is like 2 years older than ours. They can't speak each other's language, but they still hang out and have fun. It's super amazing. Yeah.
That's good stuff.
So, man. I mean, this is the thing I like about it, Craig. And I think a lot of your stuff does it too. You have to use the skills rather than just practice them, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. You have to.
Instead of just teaching it, you know, like you're just there like, all right, guys, let's do friction fire today. And let's all try and bust one out, instead of like, your requirement is this. And then I'm just sitting there watching people saying, you know, do this, do that. We all have to do stuff. And
yeah, man, I'm not that guy, dude. I'm not that guy that has a list of things to do in a class. I mean, I do have a general understanding. I want to build a foundation for people, but every class I teach is different. Every single class I teach is different. There's been people that have come back to the same class that I've taught, and they're go, wow, you didn't talk about this last time. Well, today's the day. I mean, we can't talk about it all every weekend, you know? So yeah,
that's pretty cool. I like that plastic, you know, way of teaching, because as instructors too, you don't get bored of the curriculum as well. And then the people who come back, I've got people who are coming back for their third trip. Dan Eastland of Dogwood Custom Knives was about to come for his sixth trip.
Oh, wow.
I think I've had like 10 trips total, maybe 8 trips official total. So, it keeps you interested. And when your instructors, guys, if you're looking for like quality instructors and stuff, when your instructor is interested in the subject and has passion, like Craig does, he designed his own knife based on his time out there instead of just using any knife he gets, which, you know, you can do. But you know, you're that into it that you have your own thoughts on it. Mm-hmm. That helps you get more of a cool learning experience, I think.
Yeah, I agree. Well, you covered very naturally one of the questions. I always ask about three questions of people when I interview them. Sure. One of them was, what's the most enjoyable time, which I think you mostly covered. Would you say what you just described, seeing all the critters like you did, that one of the most enjoyable times you've had in the outdoors?
Yeah. You know, for sure that would be, because that was like, you know, a kid in the candy shop, and I've been seeing all these things on National Geographic and watching, you know, so many shows, but to figure out that it's that easy to obtain, to see it, you know, it's not like, oh, you have to be able to have this much amount of money or be some tough mutter or something like that to get out in the jungle. You know, I was like, gosh, this was incredible. So, you know, I tried to make it my goal to make Bushcraft Global for anybody. You know, even if we have somebody with spine problems or something, I'd figure out a way to get them out there to have that same experience. And It's just so cool sharing that, you know, and then the bushcraft and all that comes with it, but like at 100,000 times more than what you'd encounter in the US. It's just, so we have four different tribes, the Yukuna, the Métis, the Huitoto, and the Makuna. At right now, there's some talks for some other more interesting tribes, but the Métis are pretty dang interesting. They were first contacted in 1979. So they are still super, super primitive, to the point where they don't have a written language. They, when you ask them, hey, what was it like before Close? They're like, well, I think I was either 15, 12 or 17. It was in the summertime. And that's like their way of, of, you know, doing time. And he'll, they'll tell you stories about them finding cloth from that they stole from camps. I mean, like, why the hell did the white guys wear that? You know, it's so stinky. What, why do they need that? And these stories that these guys share, like, super appreciates, helps you appreciate where you are and where you come from, and you know, helps everybody figure out their human story. And then they're doing friction fires, you know, in a different way than what you and I are used to. They're doing, you know, bow drills in the middle of 100% humidity. I mean, not bow drills, hand drills, and 100% humidity, and they are blowing on it like Godzilla. I mean, like, you know how we're like so careful with our coals, and we're just like, oh, let's prepare everything perfect. No, they're just like blowing as hard as they can communally, like five people, until they set fire to this piece of coal and capo, which is like a cotton. And it just completely rearranges everything that you've seen in the books and things that you're used to, because they're just so used to the bush, and it's really, really fun to watch them do that.
So next question then would be, what's the funniest thing you've ever experienced in the outdoors?
There are so many, but I think the cackling from all four tribes, the last trip, there's a fish, guys, there's this giant fish called an arapaima, which is like 12 feet long, can get up to like 400 pounds. It's this piradaku is another name. You've seen it on River Monsters. Consequently, on River Monsters, I get a call one day and it's like, Joe, turn to River Monsters on channel blah 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 Discovery. Ebon's in the back. One of my Métis tribe guys is on the back working the boat to bring the guy from River Monsters to Electric Eels. Oh man, that shows how legit he is. There's this thing called arapaima, and you're supposed to take a bronze spear, which I have a spearhead over there, and you shish kebab this giant fish, and then you just hang on for dear life for like 6 hours, right? You just hang out in your dugout canoe or your big, big fishing boat, and it pulls your boat until it dies. There's like no other way.
Did you say 400 pounds?
Yeah, 12 feet. I don't know exactly about the 400 pounds, but you can look it up.
Arapaima. Yeah, that's fine.
I believe it's one of the largest freshwater fish in the world. They're big enough to sink boats if they pull it wrong. So I have not ever speared one of these yet. We're going to look about possibly doing that just for me with one of the indigenous on the next trip. If it's legal, I have to ask it, you know, I'm going to be legit. They do this really crazy thing where they blow air all over a boat, like as a territorial thing, and they just go, shh. And I didn't know about that. And so we had this private lake that we were at last year, and I'm in this tiny little dugout canoe, and I know my stuff in a canoe. I just got off of 4 days on the river yesterday. My house still smells like that wonderful sour smell of wet gear.
What you're talking about.
Yeah, it's a great smell.
I hung up wet gear this morning, man. I know exactly that smell that you're talking about.
Yeah, you open up a dry bag and you just shut it together. I need to put this outside. So I know canoes, but the dugout canoes down there, they're super topsy turvy. And so I'm out there fishing for peacock bass, right? And I just hear them waiting and looking at me. Like, I don't know what they're doing. They're waiting for me to get my lure stuck, right? Or they're waiting for me to get my lure bit off by a piranha, which happens if you don't use steel leader. And so I know I'm being set up by something. All of a sudden there's a giant geyser of water. And I almost fall off my boat. I'm like, Gordon, what the heck? In proper English, is there a freaking Loch Ness monster in here? Did you set me up? What's going on? Because the whole little dugout canoe kind of moved a little bit, he didn't ram the boat or anything, but he sprayed me. And I just hear all the, everybody on the shore cackling like hyenas.
Right.
And then I find out it's the territorial response of a arapaima. And if you don't know what it is, it's really surprising at the beginning. So
right.
That's the most vivid one I remember recently.
That's awesome. And they're all just standing back watching, right? Because I mean, it was a major setup.
Yeah, it was a Monday for them though, so it was just like, watch this white guy just flip out when he gets his boat, you know, topsy turvy. I didn't fall out though, so that was cool. But yeah,
how hard was it to acclimate into that group of people? I mean,
not at all.
Are you welcome there readily, or are they cautious?
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm welcome there pretty regularly because I've done a lot of stuff with them. But
I guess I'm talking about when you started, Joe. I mean,
yeah.
How did you develop that sort of relationship? Because I can't imagine that they would be like, yeah, every white guy that I see, come on in.
I had to not be so hyper. That was the first thing.
Yeah.
I had to relax a little bit. And Gordon said, Joe, just don't be bouncing all over the place like you're Winnie the Pooh Tigger. You know, just relax around them at first and, you know, let them know that you're super interested in their culture. And so I did that. And between that and just sharing stories, I mean, they don't care about escalators or anything like that. They've seen them before, but if you show them a picture of you next to a deer or, you know, your two kids, they are all about that. And
really
and,
interesting.
Yeah. So I made friends with the tribe that way. The tribe, the different guys who have come out, they've had a great time. We've, you know, made sure that they're respected. The cool part about this, Craig, is that like I've met second generation indigenous, the kids that were born after that, and they are not the same. And essentially I'm paying the Métis tribe good money to do what they do on a Monday to keep their tradition alive. And they really appreciate that. They're like, Joe,
what did you mean, Joe, when you said that the next generation is not the same? What do you mean?
Well, I've had like the sons and stuff who were born in like the 2000s. In past contact, past 1979, in the 80s, you know, the 30-year-olds, the 20-year-olds and stuff out on the trip, but they're much better at using a lighter than they are doing the hand drill. You know, they don't wear the same garb. They don't have all of the uniform of everything that they're ready to move on. And that's, you know, that's their choice too. That's not my choice to deal with that with the tribe. But I do know that the guys who are older wholeheartedly appreciate being employed to be themselves. And I think they like that as well. That's why we have a good relationship. You know, they enjoy taking people out. We make tiny little bows that you think are for children, but we're out there shish kebabbing fish with them. They enjoy that. Although they like to learn, hey, let's mount that arrow on a slingshot and kill fish that way. They love that. They're just people like us who like to work with what they have too. And it just helps them keep that cultural heritage too.
Gotcha.
So on the trips, for instance, to give you an idea, we make the blowgun poison. You may watch the indigenous do stuff with the blowgun. That may or may not result in dinner. I will keep that very, very terse because I'm not selling a hunting trip. Make your own blowgun down there. You can make kuksas. We made baskets. I brought knife handles last year and everybody made their own, or knife blades, and people have made their own handles out of the woods, the exotic woods of the Amazon rainforest. Boat paddles, bows. Like I said before, we've made slingshots, all of that. Last year we dove down to the bottom of the lake, got clay and hand fired our own slingshot ammo, made some pottery too. There's just so much. The whole entire trip is based on crafting and getting food. You're not starved out there. Like I said, like we talked about, we want to make sure that people are happy and learning.
Right.
So you're definitely not starved. We supplement all the fish that we catch with, you know, rice, beans. We've even made bread out there. Different challenges where Gorn and I are like, dude, let's do the, you know, the bread on the stick that the Boy Scouts do out in the Amazon jungle. So it, you know, we did that successfully and it was really fun. But in the meantime, we're catching, we're fishing with both primitive techniques, trapping, bows, rod and reel, because peacock bass, right? They're like a game animal. We're also catching caiman and alligators, The indigenous may eat them, but most of the time I normally grab them before they kill them and let them go, because I really like alligators and reptiles. And it always creates a point of tension between me and the Yucuna guide, because he identifies animals as either to eat or not to eat. He just doesn't care. He's awesome. But so no gators are normally harmed. Let the baby gators go. But everybody gets a chance to catch them. You get to see monkeys. You get to catch piranha. You get to trap animals. We fish with machetes down there. You go right in front of the fish and it runs into the blade, and you don't want to swing too hard because you have to pick up two pieces of fish, and that's more work. So it's and we're doing trapping, we're doing hunting the entire time. So it's an incredible, unique Amazon jungle experience. So that's Bushcraft Global in a nutshell.
Good stuff.
And it's really cool, because a lot of these experiences, I've been humbled out there. I've had the funniest times out there. I've had the most enjoyable times out there. It's just a wonderful place to be. I love it.
Right. What do you mean by humbling? Anything that stands out to you that you can share?
Yeah. You know, besides the kids who are able to out use a knife versus a international knife designer, you know, I have over 120 designs with Condor Knife and Tool, but still this, you know, the Yucuna's daughter can pick up a broken butcher knife and out carve any type of trap I can do. That's really, truly humbling. And
I'm assuming you learn from that too, right, Joe? I mean, I know it's humbling and I get what you're saying, but you're probably learning a lot that you share with people too, right?
Oh, 100%. Yeah. You know, this is why this person can do it all day, because he grips a knife like this versus, you know, like an ice pick grip. You know, they're right, using their knife with their thumb and their forefinger, and they're able to fling it around easier and use it all day. But what they're doing, Craig, with just the stuff around them versus the ridiculous amount of money each one of us is very, very guilty of paying for our bushcraft gear, just blows my mind too. You know, I have like a $400 backpack, and they're able to make one that lasts for like 3 years out of some of the plant material down there. It takes a day or two to make, but it's not just one that they made up, which they do sometimes make some up on the fly, but that's their jungle gear. And they just put a dry bag in it, Craig. And this frame with a dry bag is more waterproof than my $400, you know,
sea lion, you know, bag or whatever.
Right, right.
Right.
But you know, the sea lion bags and stuff too, I'm actually talking with them because I own half their stuff. I really need to talk with them. That works great too. But you see how this amalgam of the new stuff and the old stuff can come together. For instance, that sea lion bag and their straps and their everything else that's in the jungle, you can put that all together and you have a really awesome setup that you don't have to think about anything about. You're not fumbling around your gear at all. It gets soaked and goes in the water. It just drains right out, but your sea lion bag is good to go. So there's a real cool amalgam that way too.
Nice.
And it's humbling because you spend so much money on this gear, but you go down there and there's 550 cord just hanging from the trees, you know, and there's knife, you know, I got a custom Kydex sheath, you know, made for my machete, but they have a special bark there for everything. And this one is the one that they use for their machete sheath, and it outlasts mine. So, that's really cool. So there's a whole thing there where you can take those skills and bring them back to the United States too. Like, okay, I don't have this bark, but we have tulip poplar in the Southeast, or we have, you know, hickory maybe up where you're at, where they make baskets out of split hickory. And right, a lot of these skills, you go, oh, wow, there was a North American precedent for that. I should try it with this.
Sure.
And it works too.
Absolutely. So you mentioned you got two trips coming up this year. Any other goals for the coming year?
Oh yeah. I'm expanding, you know. How did you do with COVID, Craig? That's the first question before I get into this. Did your online classes explode?
Yes and no. We started doing Zoom courses. That mm-hmm. that was the something that we didn't knew because of COVID, and we had no idea what was going to happen with COVID. And those went really well. And a lot of people got comfortable with the situation that we were in and started coming back outside. I went from having two classes at most a month to have something every weekend.
Good gosh. You got to be careful so you don't get burned out.
Yeah, it's definitely an issue. I mean, it's something that Jennifer, my wife, Jennifer and I have been talking about at length about how to find that downtime. And and force. I like to work and I love my work, but mm-hmm. I also am recognizing that being there every weekend is going to, it has started to burn me out. And so I got to figure that out. We all have to do that. Even though I love the work, the fortunate thing is I love people. So mm-hmm. when I go and I'm with a new group, it's a new class. I mean, cause it's new people and I love these people and I want to help them. So that helps. But it would be easy to get in those ruts that you were just mentioning where, okay, everybody's got to do this now. Everybody's got to do this now. And I'm just not mm-hmm. going to allow myself to do that. But
that's
to
go good.
Back to your original question, we have blown up. It's it's bigger than we have ever been. And it doesn't look like it's going to slow down.
Oh, man. You guys hear that, listeners? You better book your classes now with them. Or put in your bid for that knife, which the Chamonix. I was about to say the shaman. It's not the shaman. Chamonix. Whenever LT finally gets out of their rut because they're so backed up too. I mean,
bad, man.
The whole world, you know, everybody's behind trying to get steel. Heck, even the Hidden Woodsman, he can't get zippers sometimes for his packs.
That's where we are with the knife, man. I mean, we're getting. I mean, I'm talking to LT Wright later this afternoon because we had chosen ABL steel. When I say we, they had, because I was like, guys, you tell me what steel you want to put on this thing. Cause I don't know knives like you guys. Tell me what people want.
ABL is a fantastic steel.
And so we went with ABL steel. Although the knife that I received was the first knife that I ever had and owned that was ABL steel. I just trusted LT Wright because they know what they're doing.
Absolutely.
But it's getting hard to find. So we're probably going to make our first run of the Chamonix and something besides ABL. And
cool.
So we're having that conversation this afternoon because there's just issues with everything, man. Supplies. Just,
you know,
it's crazy.
With me working for Condor, of course, and that's not the only, I'm a consultant. I have brought Condor very far, but they have also brought me so much further. But they know I work with other companies. But that being said, they're one of the guys that put 1075 out on the market and 1075. And the Bushcrafter from LT Wright is a great way to do a less expensive version. I'm a 1075 user nut where I think a bunch of rust on a knife is a great way to keep more rust from happening.
Yeah.
So, you know,
man,
that Condor
Bush Lore, I have those and I lay those. So I've got about 30 knives that I lay out in front of every survival class, right?
Oh, cool.
And that's one of them. And because and this is what I say every time, Joe, you can't beat this knife for the price.
No, it's fantastic. Do you know we have a lifetime warranty too? Same as Essie?
Yeah,
no
it's
questions
just
asked. But the Bush Lore is just, you know, just like your knife. It's one of these things where it has everything that a bushcrafter would like, a point down 7.9, an ergonomic handle. You know, it's based off of the knife that Ray Mears liked to go to. He didn't really design the Shing. He adopted it as his. And that point down the center line has really morphed itself into almost every bushcrafting knife ever. Look at the Bushcrafter with LT Wright. Look at maybe even the Chamonix has a point down the center line. It's so useful. And when you put these type of features in the knife, and Mora, of course, is awesome at it, putting down a very inexpensive knife that people can just use. You know, it's great. But, you know, that's with the knife world and all that, everybody has all these goals. COVID puts them back because there's so much need for it, just like your classes as well.
Right.
And there's needs for these knives. People are sitting at home. They're buying knives like crazy. And so that's what's making the knife industry, you know, fall behind. As far as classes and stuff go, you know, I'm in the same boat as you. Things are blowing up. So I'm doing an uninhabited island trip in the Florida Keys stateside starting after January. I'll have the exact dates coming up here soon, but it's where we go to maybe two different uninhabited islands, spearfish with the spearfishing charter, learn some beach-based survival, and then also have a good time the last night. If I can do it right and get all the legal stuff fixed legal, I'll bring you guys into the Everglades and we get to look at snakes and photograph and look at, you know, maybe up to 30 snakes a night and see how the Everglades is such a neat area with reference to some of the Native American tribes that live down there. Possibly Trinidad and Tobago coming up for another uninhabited island trip and Jamaica. And then also I live off of the New River in North Carolina. I just got off of an expedition with Blue Ridge Discovery Center, which is a non-for-profit. I really like working with kids, Craig, because sometimes they can appreciate, you know, like a caterpillar more than, you know, like the crazy tactical dude might. which I like both. Don't get me wrong, but you know, kids can keep up with me sometimes with my energy level. So it really works well to take them out on the river. And Blue Ridge Discovery Center, that's an outfit that I work for sometimes that really takes biology and the biological aspect of camping. And so we're not just, you know, canoeing on the river. We're snorkeling half the time. We're getting trash and trying to figure out how to start fires with some of the stuff we find on the river. And so all sorts of fun stuff, but, it's really easy for me to do a new river, expedition. So I'm going to be doing that in the future too, because it's in my backyard. But right. they're not training based. They're more expedition based, mm-hmm. and you get the training with it. You know, if somebody really wants to get solid training, they should go to like Nature Reliance School or places along that line. But this is more just like a experience based thing. We're like, hey, we're going to go out on the river and do this. And from
that's
then
what a
on,
lot of our military contract stuff is. We've done some adventure programming with our military groups, and that's I did one 2 weeks ago, and that's where you get to go have fun. We ziplined and canoed. I mean, it was awesome. Really a learning event, right? I mean, it's just hey, let's go out and experience outdoors together and have fun doing it.
Right. But if you're ziplining or canoeing, you have a chance to work on these things. What happens if you tip? Hypothermia. Okay. What do we do? Ziplining. Okay. We need to, everybody remember how to do your figure eights.
Right.
You know, there's all these little aspects of just being outdoors that works great. Sure. Also, do you know, Georgia Bushcraft?
I do. I'm teaching for them this fall.
Awesome. So they're, as you know, they're an amazing group. Casey's done a really good job with that. I challenged them with the machete only class. So possibly like a 3 day where you only get a big knife. You can dress up as Rambo, do whatever you want, but you're going to have to use that big knife only. It's like the 80s style of survival. I kind of want to bring that back because Doug Meyer, one of the best primitive skills guys of the Southeast, who you know pretty well.
Yep.
You can find Doug Meyer on Instagram, guys, was telling me these mouth watering stories of taking ninjutsu classes in the 80s and survival classes in the 80s where they had to learn how to climb up a well and do crazy stuff. I'm like, what happened to all that? You know, we didn't get softer people. Yeah, no, just people forgot that was still fun.
If you do a Rambo class, I've got to find a way to get there.
Is that what we're calling it?
I don't know. You call it whatever you want to. But that's
Craig Cottle's Rambo class.
And 80s, Kevin Estella will be there too. I'm just telling you.
All right, that now we got it. Now
the
80s
survival class.
The Rambo class. I'm coming. You can bring whatever gear you like. It just has to be a knife over 9 inches.
I got
you know what? I might
set.
Just complete. Yeah. You're set with the Chamonix.
Yeah.
I'm probably going to go ridiculous and do it with the Crocodile Dundee knife.
There you go.
There you go. Not one of these Joe Flowers designs. Yeah. Right. We're going to do it with the 440C Outback from down under. I had nothing to do with it that way. It's got to be the archer, not the bow, right?
So right. There you go.
Really, really test your skills. And everybody has to have a red bandana.
There we go. That's it. I love it. I absolutely love that.
So, I mean, it's wonderful to hear that everybody's growing so much. What kind of classes do you have coming up?
So this coming weekend, I'm going to Pennsylvania teaching tracking and land navigation for fieldcraft survival.
Oh, cool.
The weekend after that, I'm teaching tracking here in Kentucky for a day. We added that last year too, pre-COVID, but that turned out to be really well. Just 1 day courses, because we've always done 3 day courses, and we added 1 day courses in for people that have kids, have pets, have livestock, can't spend the night,
for
whatever reason.
Yeah.
And so those have been incredibly popular.
Count me in for any of your tracking classes. I need to take an official tracking class. I haven't. I don't track. I just know, you know, the backwoodsman tracking a buck or a wounded animal through the forest. I'd love to take one of your classes.
Yeah, I love tracking's my gig, man. I love it. If I could teach tracking every day, it would be a good day.
I
absolutely love it. And I do track every day. I mean, I just don't get to teach it every day, right? But
if
I can make a living doing what I do every day, because I have a new puppy, and so we've committed to 2 day, 2 hours almost every morning at
day. What kind of dog?
It's an Australian Shepherd. Looks just like the dog that I just saw walk behind you.
Yeah, I was about to say we have a mutt. She's down there.
I saw
12 years old. Just super, you know, that's the best part about those dogs. Their prey drive is so good that they're so easily trainable.
Yeah. Yeah. This dog's been a good dog, but he's high energy like you. So I've got to get him out. I've got to get him out in the woods every day. So that just gives me the excuse to go tracking on my own. Right. So that works good. Well, dude, tell everybody that's listening where they can find you.
I am out in the bush cutting stuff a lot, but I have a website that I'm working on, bushcraftglobal.com. Bushcraftglobal.com. If you guys are interested, it's new. Of course, during COVID, like a lot of people, I started to focus on social media and all that. So Instagram, Bushcraft Global. I'm not working on YouTube so much right now, just because, you know, like Craig, you know, we're gone every weekend and stuff. We don't have time in some aspects to do some of these things. So I'm working off of Instagram-ish and Facebook, Bushcraft Global. If you're interested in some of my knife designs, you can go to condortoolandknife.com or Topps Knives. And there's going to be some future other companies, not just Artisan, that are coming up. I'm working with Grim Survival on a card, because we actually use a lot of the stuff off of their cards down in the Amazon. And a couple of other fun things that'll come up, just because, you know, Craig, this world right now that we're in, and I even saw it at Blade Show, everybody's more collaborative. We had to go through all this stuff alone, and now so many people are working together. I mean, you've had Kevin come teach at some of your classes and stuff, and, you know, trying to get people to teach here and there or work together in the knife world here and there was hard, but now everybody's all for it. And so, you know, community has been huge. So a lot of different community places on Facebook, even Bushcraft USA, they're starting to become huge again. I'm running around all those places too. So that's where you can find me. Instagram's a big one. Of course, bushcraftglobal@gmail.com if you're interested in trips. I also do custom trips down in South America, all the way up here to North America as well. So if you don't want to do a 12-day trip, or you have a specific thing, even fixing, I've fixed stuff for TV production companies down in the Amazon too. So if people just want to go down there and film and have a good time, let me know. But I'm also interested in whatever else is going on too. So if you have a bushcraft meetup or something like that, you know, let me know as well, because I just went over to Camp Craft Outdoors in your neck of the woods and had a great time meeting people. Sure. This is one of the places where, like, Jamie Burley was like, Joe, go do a bow drill with, you know, just the material up here, and he challenged a bunch of the instructors to do that. And that was super cool, because being in the Southeast, my first thing to go to is, of course, pine and fatwood and all this stuff that's just lying everywhere. So I'm up in Kentucky, and about the best thing I could find was cedar, and I was able to pull it out of the woods with no prep. But, you know, I had not been challenged like that in a while, so it's fun to go to some of these events and just go work on skills rather than teach.
Right, that's good, man. This has been fun, Joe. Thanks for taking the time to be here, brother. I appreciate it very much.
Sure. And let me know if you guys want me to come back on. I'd love to do my own podcast, but, you know, it's a time thing. So it's cool to come on here to see such a well-prepared and well-sounding. Your new microphones sound great, by the way.
Thanks, man. Thanks.
A place like you guys.
Yeah.
Where do we find out more about your stuff, Craig?
They know. Everybody that's listening here knows. It's all, and that should be brought up too. All the things that Joe just mentioned, everybody that's listening, I'm gonna have links in the description, so that way you can just click and go right to Joe's website and his Instagram and all that good stuff. But yeah, naturereliance.org for everything Nature Reliance School.
Cool. Are you if you're org, do you have nonprofit stuff too?
We don't right now, but we're really close. But that's
all right.
If you're let me
know in the future. I love helping
news too.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, that's really, really close to being done.
Oh, cool. So, well, if it's any, I'm down for helping with anything, but if you guys need donations for non-for-profit stuff to help, you know, getting people in the outdoors or something like that, just let me know. Okay. Every kid needs a machete.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I will. I'll hit you up then. I love putting sharp knives in kids' hands and showing them how to use
Heck
it. Right.
Yeah. Hey, you know, one of the ways of getting around that, you know, legally rise, because, you know, the kids can handle themselves, those Kevlar gloves, you can pick them up big packs on eBay. And then if you say, hey, they have the Kevlar gloves, and you can get away with a lot, because liability wise, let's be frank, that's hard to do with young kids and cutting tools.
Sure.
So that's one way to really get kids to learn, you know, how to appreciate it. That if that helps you, it helps you. If not, hey.
No, that's good, man. I like it.
It only takes two people to cut themselves, experts and beginners.
Right, right. Yeah, that's for sure. Well, thanks, Joe. We'll cut you off. Too. Yeah, it's been good, man. And I wish you much, much continued success, my friend. Appreciate it.
Hey, you too. It's been an honor to be on here and to see how much you guys are growing. Keep tracking stuff, dude. It's incredible.
Man. Yeah, I will. Thanks, brother.
Thanks.
And that wraps up another fantastic episode of the Nature Reliance Podcast. I hope today's journey has inspired you to explore and connect with the natural world in new and exciting ways. Before I say goodbye, remember to check out the Nature Reliance School online membership. If today's episode sparked your interest in wilderness skills and outdoor adventures, this online community is the perfect place for you to start or continue your journey. You can currently sign up for a year for only $99 and get 2 months for free. Click the link below to discover a world of expert-led courses, engaging content, and a vibrant community eager to share their knowledge and experiences. Whether you're starting your outdoor journey or looking to deepen your existing skills, the Nature Reliance School online membership is here to guide you. Thank you for joining us today. Don't forget to subscribe for more adventures and share this podcast with your fellow nature enthusiasts. Until next time, come on, join in. Let's learn together.